All right, it's a rockin' world, Joe Strummer. Welcome to another edition of the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. Towards the back end of the show, everyone is thinking about Haiti these days. There should be a lot of compassion. There's a lot of anger, a lot of compassion, just a lot of caring for what's going on and people searching for ways to deal with that. Towards the back end of the show, I'm going to do something I don't do that often, which is read a statement that was issued by the Revolution editors, Revolution newspaper editors on Haiti. Before that, we'll be talking with Jennifer Pizer, the National Marriage Project Director for Lambda Legal, about the Prop 8 case up in San Francisco. Jennifer's been there, and she wrote a very interesting article on what's really behind banning the videotaping and the cameras in the courtroom. We're also going to talk to Douglas Fisher, the editor of the Daily Climate and the author of Disappearing Options, which was based on a study published in Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, which basically says, hey, you know what? It's not just the environment itself that has a tipping point, but climate policy has a tipping point. We're going to dig into that and hear what he's talking about. But before all that, we are going to spend some time with a colleague of mine from Revolution Newspaper, a frequent guest on this show, Larry Everest. He's a writer for Revolution, the author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq and the U.S. Global Agenda. And we're going to be talking about the continuing upsurge in Iran. You know, in late December, central Tehran and other cities looked like a war zone as fearless crowds battled security forces, who in turn unleashed mega repression, opening fire, killing many. The situation is complex and rapidly changing, and here to talk with us about it is Larry Everest. Larry, welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael. Good to be with you.
Let's jump right into this. The situation, as I said, it's very complex. It seems to be rapidly changing. What is the current situation in Iran today?
Well, in December, there was a wave of protest that was both more continuous and more radical and confrontational than what we had seen before. It began December 7th with National Student Day protests across the country. Scattered protests continued, and then on December 19th, one of the Ayatollahs, Ayatollah Montazeri, who had been one of the founders of the Islamic Republic but had become a reformist critic, in other words, someone who wanted to maintain an Islamic Republic but had differences with the current ruling clique, died on the 19th of December, and that unleashed a further, basically after December 19th, there were continuous protests in many different parts of Iran, and this culminated on Ashura, which is itself the culmination of the month of Muharram, which is an important Shia religious celebration. And the opposition was being subject to tremendous repression, so people have been using these days when there are going to be official holidays or official protests, or traditionally there have been celebrations and marches, to express their anger at the regime. And so during this period, and especially on December 28th and continuing afterward, many tens of thousands of people took to the street in Tehran and across the country. The Communist Party of Iran, Marxist-Leninist Maoist, estimated 1 million people in total across Iran, several hundred thousand in scattered demonstrations in Tehran on December 28th alone. Now, recall, Michael, that prior to these demonstrations, the regime is directly warning people that they can be killed. People understand they can be shot, they can be imprisoned, they can be tortured. Yet people came out in their tens of hundreds of thousands. And one of the things that was different about this wave of protest was people's fearlessness. Often there'll be crowds of people, and the regime will send crews of motorcycle thugs, the Basiji or the Revolutionary Guards, the police and so on, to tear gas people, to hit them with batons, to run over people, in some cases to shoot at people. And often the crowds have scattered, but if you look at the YouTube, there's a lot of good YouTube video available. You'll see that the protesters in many cases were standing their ground, or even I just watched one which really hundreds and hundreds of protesters surrounded a group of motorcycle police and just beat them up and knocked them off their motorcycles. You had women coming to these demonstrations. They've been increasingly on the front lines of this struggle, many without wearing the scarf or only wearing it partway in defiance of the Islamic rules. And the slogans have continued to be down with the supreme leader, death to the supreme leader. These are the Ali Khamenei. This is something that was really taboo to even say something.
Well, it's somewhat removed from the I want my vote cry that was characterizing a lot of the uprisings that first began a while back.
Well, that's right, and that's an important point, because what begins as an argument in the ruling class, and I think that's how we have to understand what happened during the June election, including the verbal pyrotechnics between Ahmadinejad and Mousavi, which was also unprecedented. This division unleashed, and then the apparent theft of the election unleashed a big argument in the ruling class, and this crack allowed the people of Iran to express deep discontent over the whole situation. Yes, immediately focused on the vote, as you said, but really evolving. It's obviously a complicated and multi-layered protest. The issue of the vote and the election is still there, but there's been a radicalization in which people have more and more expressed anger at the whole direction the country's going, including some people at the very concept of an Islamic Republic.
We're talking with Larry Everest, the journalist with Revolution Newspaper, about the situation in Iran today. You mentioned the role of women in all this. There's something very significant about women stepping out in as major a way as they have been in Iran these days. Can you talk about that some?
The whole Islamic Republic and a core principle of this Islamic fundamentalism that's become such a big force across the Middle East and Central Asia, it's founded on a reassertion of patriarchy and a reassertion of male supremacy and the suppression and control of women. This gets expressed in terms of very draconian laws against adultery, including stoning. It gets expressed in codes saying women's testimony is half a man's, women's inheritance rights. In Iran, the most visible symbol of this is what one ayatollah called the culture of hijab or the scarf. The covering that forces women to be completely covered when they go out, except for their, in Iran, it's hands and face. As a symbol of the control of women and women's sexuality by men, there's actually a very interesting article in the Middle East Report, Broken Taboos in Post-Election Iran, that discusses this. So the notion of women going out, raising slogans, down with the regime, down with the supreme leader, coming out, being on the front lines of the protest, not always, not all of them, some of them not wearing the hijab. This cuts to the very heart of what this Islamic Republic is founded on, and is both an expression of the deep, deep discontent of women. And this article in Mira points out that men and women are questioning these gender and sexual codes and so on. I mean, you cannot get to know, have a girlfriend without parents' approval and all this other patriarchal control. So this is something that goes right to the foundation of reactionary Islamic Republic and could potentially be a big force in unraveling and delegitimizing it.
That's an extremely important point. That leads into what I wanted to ask you. While it's not a revolutionary situation in Iran, it's clear that very significant changes have come about. The role of women, the fearlessness of the people, the trend towards radicalization among a significant section of people. This also must be causing some very, very sharp divisions. I mean, you can see all this actually cracking the foundation of the society. But in doing so, there has to be quite a few divisions within the Iranian ruling class, too.
Well, there are and there aren't. I mean, they're contradictory trends. On one hand, the regime has reacted to all this. They sent that this could be something that leads to their downfall. There is that potential. They sense that, and they've reacted accordingly. I mean, in Ashura, there were instances of the police firing live rounds directly into the crowds. I mean, the official reports are 8 people murdered, but I've seen estimate 30 and 40, and who knows, maybe more. There's been a wide-ranging attack on different opposition figures. The nephew of Mousavi was was assassinated on Oshawa. There were shots taken at Karobi, one of the other. And again, these Mousavi and Karobi are ruling class figures. And it was interesting that Mousavi and recently Hatemi, who was another reformist and former presidential candidate, denounced those who were calling for an end to the Islamic Republic or calling for an Iranian Republic or being too radical. So that was very interesting. So you do have a number of opposition papers, a number of the support staff for these different reformist Islamist leaders have been arrested. So there have been crackdowns on the curricula in the universities. There have been attacks on Iranians overseas, often Iranians overseas, if they're seen taking pictures of them at anti-regime demonstrations, their parents or their family can get visited in Iran. So there's a widespread crackdown on this. At the same time, you have figures like Rafsanjani and Mousavi trying to convince the other faction here that, look, don't go this way. You could unravel the whole thing. We had a very interesting statement by Khamenei that was reported in the Los Angeles Times in which he's saying, yes, keep order, but no, don't do vigilante justice, speaking to the Basiji and others. This couldn't let things get out of control. So there's a lot of argument and division here over how to hold this reactionary Islamic Republic together.
Now, we've got about 5 minutes left, and I wanted to ask you this. It's disgusting, the kind of response that's coming from the U.S. ruling class. All of this sort of concern, this voicing of so-called concern over the position of the Iranian people and saying that, look, we support the Iranian people fighting their just struggle for freedom of choice and the freedom to vote and freedom of life. Can you talk about what the U.S. role in all this is?
Well, that's an important point, because one of the reasons we attach and are so heartened by what the masses of people in Iran are doing is, first, when millions of people rise up and defy death and fight for liberation and justice, it's an inspiring thing, and there's not nearly enough of this in the world today. But even more than that, the struggle in Iran has the potential to be part of bringing forward another way that rejects both imperialism and Islamic fundamentalism and helps break this deadly spiral where they're reinforcing each other now. And one of the reasons there's potential, and this is what you're pointing to, is the history of Iran. Look, the U.S. claims to be friends of the Iranian people. The U.S. installed the Shah of Iran that tortured people in front of their families. He was a torturer so hated he was overthrown in 1979. When that happened, the U.S. conspired to assist the Khomeini forces in coming to power because the U.S. feared even deeper, more radical revolution. And of course, this Islamic Republic has been responsible for the death of thousands and thousands of communists, of Democrats, of intellectuals, of progressives and revolutionaries of different kinds. And now the U.S. rulers are trying to use this struggle in order to weaken the Islamic Republic, perhaps even overthrow it, and strengthen their hold on Iran. But if you actually look at it, the most fundamental problem, the most fundamental source of the oppression of the Iranian people is imperialist domination, which this Islamic Republic has not broken from, including the ways imperialism reinforces feudalism and traditionalism and so on. And let's not forget, Michael, that as the U.S. talks about being friends of the Iranian people, they're also talking about the potential for devastating sanctions and for military attack against Iran. And I just have to say that Petraeus, General David Petraeus, the head of CENTCOM, was interviewed the other day, and he said, sure, we do have plans. We, the U.S., have plans for attacking Iran, and certainly we can attack their nuclear facilities. They're not invulnerable. So this is looming very, very large in the air, even as the U.S. is discussing support for the demonstrators. And I also just have to say, look at the hypocrisy here. Are the U.S. rulers expressing support for the demonstrations of Palestinians against the siege of Gaza, or the demonstration of Pakistanis and Afghanis against the murder of civilians? No, we hear nothing of that. What about those demonstrations?
All right, Larry, I want to thank you very much for joining us today, and we will have to have you back. I know the next big date in Iran coming up is the anniversary of the founding of the Islamic Republic, and that could be, there's a lot of people, a lot of commentators pointing to that as another potential day of massive upsurge in Iran. So we'll definitely be talking to you before then. And
good
thank
to talk to you,
you
Michael.
Too. And let me remind listeners that we've been talking with Larry Everest, and you can get his article, which is Fearless Upsurge Rocks Iran, at revcom.us or in Revolution Newspaper. I want to remind you that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm Michael Slate, your host. We're going to take a short break and be right back with Douglas Fisher. Sound the Alarm by Thievery Corporation from their CD Radio Retaliation. You know, that's the most appropriate song I could think of on every level to go into our next conversation. You know, it's very, very heavy when you think about what's been going on in the world. And I know it's you know, this whole question of climate has really, it knocked me upside the head. Even the stuff that got revealed around Copenhagen, the understanding that people have done a lot of talking about tipping points in the environment and in the state of the world, things where there might be such catastrophic change that even more catastrophic developments in terms of the existence of humans, the continued existence of the planet, viable life on this planet is being called into question. And the other day I was just searching around, looking across some things around the climate, and I came across an article by Douglas Fisher, the editor of The Daily Climate. And the article he wrote was on disappearing options, and it was based on a study published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Douglas, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Michael. It's a pleasure to be here.
All right. Well, let's jump into this, man. You know, the thing that caught me in your article was the first sentence. Turns out climate policy has some tipping points. Now, for people, you know, for me, tipping points was always kind of, it was a vague notion until just really frankly, and maybe it's my own ignorance, but until a couple months ago, understanding that tipping points actually does imply the possibility of catastrophic irreversible change. And now you're saying climate policy has some tipping points. Can you explain what you're talking about?
Well, that's correct. I mean, the key word that I think there is irreversible. And it turns out there were some scientists at the National Center for Atmospheric Research here in Boulder, Colorado, where I am, and in the Netherlands and Austria, looked at various emission scenarios and what would happen if we fail to meet and set targets for in the next 40 years, for, say, the middle of the century, 2050. And they found that depending on how we act by 2050, it essentially limits our options, our ability, society's ability to get to some goals. It limits our ability to get to goals set further out into the end of the century, 2100. If we want to prevent the worst kind of warming and we fail to make cuts by 2050, we essentially can't get there. It's what they call a frontier, that there is no way, unless you rely on some sort of pie-in-the-sky technology such as geoengineering, space mirrors, some sort of yet-to-be-invented carbon dioxide scrubber, without those kind of science fiction efforts, you cannot keep the climate the way we kind of expect it to be now.
Wait a minute. You mean that there isn't a giant carbon dioxide scrubber? Because I just got offered a job as a giant carbon dioxide scrubber. So that's science fiction?
Three,
I don't
actually,
know.
You kind of qualify.
Okay. But well, one of the things, not to make light of this, but actually, you know, you mentioned frontiers. Now, in your article, you talk about that this study that was published talking about feasibility frontiers. Can you explain that a little more?
That notion that if we don't do enough, or if we don't take certain action by 2050, so if we don't cut our emissions by, say, in half or even by 20%, we essentially reduce our odds of being able to keep climate within this window that we feel that scientists have identified as kind of safe for civilization. And so you essentially take options off the table, this frontier. So if you step beyond this frontier, if you do not make the cuts by 2050. And most societies are talking about, say, a 50% cut. They're aiming for a kind of a 50% cut by 2050 or even a 30% cut. You reduce your odds, or you essentially say, well, then we're not going to be able to preserve options kind of going forward. If we want to keep carbon dioxide levels at a certain level, you know, folks have been talking about 350 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere or 450. We essentially can't get there.
Now, let me ask you this, because this study, and I guess actually these feasibility frontiers, are they the same as these mid-century thresholds that you're talking about?
They're kind of similar. So it says, depending on where you set your threshold is where you will land on this frontier. And so if you want to hold one of the main goals identified in Copenhagen, and it was kind of a breakthrough goal, is that the world's leaders agreed, you know, tacitly agreed that we should hold planetary warming to less than 2 degrees or less Celsius by the end of the century, by 2100. And this notion of a frontier says, okay, well, if you want that as a goal, then society as a whole, the world's communities, must limit carbon dioxide to emissions to a certain level by 2050 in order to keep that as an option for 2100. Does that make sense?
Yeah. When you're talking about what happened in Copenhagen, and I think this is something, you know, we kicked this around a little bit yesterday in the brief couple minutes we talked, this idea that, yes, it seems very easy on one level, although even there it wasn't that easy. There was still a lot of argument and a lot of even the idea that China keeps getting hit for being the massive polluter it is. And actually, no one wants to talk about that. Most of the stuff that China's doing there is directly financed and investments by U.S. imperialism. And so you have this thing of this very cagey thing that was going on in Copenhagen among the great powers, the huge, gigantic powers that have structured and run the world. So it's easy on one hand for them to say, yeah, we're down for getting these emissions down, we're down for getting the greenhouse gases down. But then the thing you're pointing to is that there's no dealing with the short-term thing. And one of the things I was talking with you about yesterday, it seems that there's actually a big problem, because these people are so vested, this system is so vested in this fossil fuel-driven economy. All of their technology, all these other things are so much rooted in that, and it would cost so much and may require such a major radical restructuring that in the immediate future, it doesn't seem like it's very likely to me. I'd like to get your opinion on that, because we're talking about, these cats that wrote this report are talking about 2050. Don't want to sound the alarm. Yes, I do want to sound the alarm. 40 years. This is a huge question.
Essentially around the corner. And no, you're very correct. I mean, there are several very extraordinarily knotty issues at play here in terms of a global agreement on carbon emissions. The first that you identified is that, yes, okay, you have a very embedded status quo. And for the developed world, that's a real problem. But in some ways, and to me, that's the smaller of the two problems. And that, you know, you have a lot of, yes, you have a very embedded industry and you're definitely getting a lot of pushback from, you know, West Virginia coal, from Oklahoma oil, you know. But Europe is moving forward with cuts. You know, the United States, I mean, I was listening to Todd Stern. This is the U.S. chief climate envoy, you know, climate negotiator. And he said yesterday that Obama is committed to changing this paradigm, changing the status quo, to moving forward with getting some sort of emissions regulations or a climate bill out there. So I'm thinking, you know, you're going to see some change over the next 5-10 years, which is significant. I mean, Todd Stern, the climate negotiator, was very optimistic about what was in the Copenhagen Agreement in terms of these limits that the world is kind of beginning to accept. To me, the harder problem and the thornier issue is you have almost 3 billion people on this globe today who basically use wood or dung for fuel. And as those folks come online, they are clamoring to say, hey, wait, the rich of the world are using, have enjoyed all the conveniences of fossil fuels. And now you're going to say, we can't benefit from this. And so that's the question. How do you, this kind of climate equity, how do you say everyone has a certain right to this emission space?
A quick reminder, we're talking with Douglas Fisher, the editor of The Daily Climate, about a new study warning that if serious near-term measures are not taken now to deal with the kind of catastrophe that's building up in relation to the climate, it may just prove to be impossible to achieve the long-term goals that everybody generally considers necessary to save the planet. Now, Doug, in a larger sense, I mean, I'm always hesitant, and you know, hesitant. I don't. I refuse to blame the people of the world for, and I'm not saying you're doing this, but I'm saying this is actually a lot of times what comes out in these various conferences is that people are burning fossil fuel and they don't want to give it up. I mean, look, they have made businesses, investment businesses, out of the right to have certain amounts of emissions. I mean, this is what this system does, is it suddenly turned even the pollution and the hurtling towards death of the planet into investment capital. You know, it's like, it's really an obscene direction that things are going in. And even call me crazy, but I'll tell you what, I think every time people should learn something at a certain point, all this change Obama's talking about, we've seen what that actually comes to. And frankly, it wouldn't have been that big a deal if you really were committed to this, to go to that Copenhagen conference and saying, all right, look, this is it. This is what we're doing. We're faced with a situation where in 40 years, we have to have some major changes or this planet may not even be viable. I know you've talked in your article about there's a certain urgency. And I was reading in this other abstract of the main study, you know, the point that these people explored things like these different scenarios and the what would happen with the business as usual scenario. And if you just allowed that to happen, or what if, which is very much more likely, the demand for energy and land grow more rapidly over the next years, and what's going to be happening in 2050? What would need to happen and what the situation would be? And they came to a very, very stunning conclusion that this is achieving, achieving the reductions that you need by 2050 is barely feasible.
Yes, no, exactly. The caveat that you have to add to that is that this is essentially, it's a computer model. And it's one of the first of its kind to look at this. And this is kind of the frontier of computer modeling. This is where the climate effort is kind of going to focus on next. And so we'll see a refinement of this and possible changes in these concepts. But I think the whole premise is still sound. And if you, yes, the job gets considerably harder as energy demand increases. You know, if you increase energy demand, as more of the global south kind of comes online energy-wise, it puts more stress on the global infrastructure. And yes, you have a harder time meeting these both midterm and long-range targets.
You know, one thing I was going to say too, though, I was just thinking this is something worth chewing on for a little bit, is, you know, this idea of the people who are burning fossil fuel and all this and saying, look, these guys are polluting the hell out of the world and we have a right to actually make use of this stuff. I think that the vast majority of people would say, you know, we would much rather have a life where we don't have to make charcoal, sell charcoal to stay alive or burn fossil fuels to stay warm or cook or anything. I mean, I remember being in Soweto in the 1980s, and when it got 5 o'clock, it was pitch dark, no matter what time of the year it was, because there was so much coal fire there and you couldn't breathe. It was just this cloud of coal smoke everywhere. You could go anywhere and people did not want to live like that. But there's a certain relation set up in the world that forces people to live like that.
Certainly, certainly. And in some ways, you're starting to also see this split in the global political world, where it is kind of those so-called least developed countries where that are kind of still cooking on charcoal and open fires and dung, that they are really pushing hard for an agreement, for caps on emissions, for technology transfer that allows them to kind of bypass the fossil fuel era. The harder part is you have these big kind of the big developing economies, China, India, Brazil, South Africa, that are saying, wait a minute, we are in the process of lifting millions of people out of poverty, and we don't want to jeopardize that progress.
Then you have to also, like I said before, you have to look at what's the role of the U.S. investment in there. And also one of the things that really, you know, should freak a lot of people out when you look at the largest companies in the world, the vast majority of them are car companies and oil companies, which are like, let's go. It's like the world's run by a bunch of snidely whiplashes, okay?
Well, yeah, that goes to this, you know, and that again speaks to that earlier point, is the dominant paradigm right now is fossil fuel, mm-hmm. You know, and how do you switch that paradigm? And in some ways, I was speaking a while back with a fellow at MIT who studies these paradigm shifts, and he finds that it's always the dominant industry never makes that shift, never sees the change coming. It's trying to adjust. You know, it's like General Motors saying, oh, yeah, we'll have, they said back in 2003, we'll have 1 million fuel cell vehicles on the road by 2010. Here we are.
Yep.
So it's the dominant industry that never makes the switch. And so it's the Teslas, it's the other kind of cars, you know, other industries that make that shift. I mean, if you could look at back London in the 1890s, they were, you know, I don't know if this might be apocryphal, but they were predicting that, oh, by the end of the 21st century, London will be buried beneath 6 feet of horse manure.
Wow.
You
know?
Wow.
Woo! Don't buy a house in London, okay?
Yeah, but that also speaks to this danger of these kind of long-term, I mean, this is kind of the flip side. It speaks to the danger of these long-term predictions that
Absolutely. You
can't account for these phase changes, these technology shifts. This paper looking at these midterm targets and the need to really cramp down, you know, essentially said we can't account for long-term targets such as massive societal change in terms of consumerism or, you know, space mirrors or new technologies. They just don't account for that.
Right.
And there's a good chance that our energy, you know, our energy portfolio is going to look radically different by the end of the 21st century.
Well, radically different can be many things, though, and that's the point. I mean, I have, you know, I can't myself, in my own view, I can't abstract this out from the we live in a system where, frankly, the goal of, you know, when you can look at the climate disaster and try to turn it into profit, that reminds me when Edward Teller and they were talking about the problem with the nuclear winter, and Edward Teller was arguing in favor of nuclear winter by saying, well, perhaps we can have it just affect the Soviet bloc, you know, and then it would be okay. I mean, these people have a very warped view of the world, driven by the fact that the profit is what they're after. Douglas, well, I want to thank you very much. We actually have to run, but I want to thank you very much for joining us. And real quick, maybe if you could emphasize what you think is the urgency of this.
Well, the urgency is that we still need to act now to preserve options for our grandkids. That's basically the bottom line. The less we do now, the less options the future is going to have.
Yeah, exactly. Very important point. Douglas, we're going to have you back. I enjoyed talking with you.
Certainly, Michael. It was a great pleasure.
Okay, talk to you again soon, man. I want to remind listeners that this is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. We've been talking with Douglas Fisher, the editor of The Daily Climate. Still to come in the show is a statement from the editors of Revolution Newspaper on the situation in Haiti. And coming up next, we'll be talking with Jennifer Pizer from Lambda Legal about the courtroom battle over Proposition 8. Now, Proposition 8 was the ballot initiative that was voted into law in California in 2008, and it banned gay marriage. We're going to take a short break and be right back with Jennifer Pizer, so stay tuned. Can't get that song out of my head. It's such a beautiful song. Leslie Gore, You Don't Own Me, and full of the kind of defiance I think that is really important in relation to what we're going to be talking about now. Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. Back in 2008, a coalition of Christian fascists, homophobes, and reactionary conservatives managed to place an initiative banning gay marriage on the California ballot. In the election, this initiative, Proposition 8, was passed into law, and with the swipe of a ballot, one of the most basic human rights, the right to love and marry who you will, was ripped away from an entire group of people. On January 11th of this year, a court case challenging the constitutionality of Proposition 8 opened up in the federal court in San Francisco. I want to welcome to the show Jennifer Pizer, who's the Marriage Project Director of Lambda Legal, and she's been up in the Bay Area talking or attending the trial, the Prop 8 trial, and writing about it, blogging about it. And she recently wrote a piece titled Cut, Why Did the Supreme Court Ban Videocasting of the Olsen Boys Marriage Trial? Jennifer, welcome to the show.
Hey, happy to be with you.
Let's jump into this. You talk about this, about the banning. I mean, it's one thing people, a lot of people were just sort of grumbling and, you know, well, we won't learn a lot about it. But you actually were really troubled by the fact that the Supreme Court made this decision to ban videocasting for public viewing, even at other federal courthouses, let alone on YouTube. They basically said there aren't going to be any cameras in the courtroom. And you're very troubled about that. Why?
Well, let me correct one thing. The cameras are still in the courtroom, the video cameras. They are capturing the testimony and the argument. And Judge Walker has said that he's going to keep that tape at least for a period of time so he personally can review it as he's writing his decision.
So it just won't be public then?
But it will not be public. And as you said, we are enormously disappointed that it is not going to be available to the public. Both the first plan that had been announced in keeping with the Ninth Circuit's pilot program to make these proceedings available to the general public, it had been to post at the end of the day the proceedings of the day to be viewable through the court's website and perhaps also through links on YouTube. That would have been tremendously valuable for the public. It turns out that the court has technical issues to sort out about how such things would work, and so that's not possible. So that was taken off the table a little while ago. The plan that was scotched here was to have the proceedings viewable in courthouses in some select cities where they have video conferencing facilities. It was to be in Pasadena and Portland, in Brooklyn. I can't remember the full list. That's what the Supreme Court has blocked. And what it's particularly troubling to me for a couple of different reasons. One is that it really was extraordinary for the U.S. Supreme Court to interfere and micromanage at this level with the operations decisions and administrative management decision of a local court. The federal court system has all sorts of rules about which part of the judiciary has responsibility to manage which parts of their operations. And the U.S. Supreme Court simply does not get involved in this kind of decision. So it was quite an extraordinary move. And the dissent speaks very respectfully, but firmly and in detail about how peculiar, to be polite about it, this order was. And you know, part of the problem was that the decision to videocast these proceedings to other courtrooms was done in keeping with, or as lawyers would say, pursuant to, the pilot program approved by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal. I mean, the Chief Judge Kaczynski of the Ninth Circuit and a committee that he has been working with has been looking for quite some time for appropriate ways to bring the court system more into the 21st century and honor the commitment that the federal judiciary has to having open proceedings, kind of recognizing the changes in technology and how they now work and their standard for most of us in the public. He's very interested in these things. They've been working. They set up a pilot program. So a lot of effort went into the decision within the court system to make this proceeding available within the pilot program. And the majority opinion of the Supreme Court just sort of gives the back of the hand to that careful work and the coordination that was going on between the Court of Appeal planning process and the district court, where Judge Walker, who is presiding over this trial, is the chief judge of the district court. And so there was close planning, careful planning about having this particular trial be a test run of that process. And the U.S. Supreme Court has really just dismissed all of that careful effort.
Let me ask you this, because you also make a point, and this is something that really struck me, that this was particularly troubling to you because in its accommodation to Prop 8's proponents' supposed fears of harm, which to me, really, in terms of the battle for public opinion and the battle to actually, to you know, you think about this. First, we had to go through the disgrace of putting basic human rights up to a vote for whether gay people are allowed to get married and, frankly, to even love each other. And that got put up to a vote. That, to me, is just intolerable. But then there's also this point about now there's this situation where just slightly under the surface of this we don't want cameras is also this idea that, and it's being propagated by, you know, some of the, you know, frankly, the morons that will be testifying in favor of Prop 8, the idea that they somehow are the victims in all this and that they may be harmed by publicity and their faces being out there and all this. And you make some very compelling points and arguments around it, and I'd like you to talk about that a little bit.
You're exactly right. I think an enormous problem, a distortion, and I sometimes think of it as a through-the-looking-glass kind of a situation, that the groups that raised millions and millions of dollars to pump out ads that demonize gay people, that suggest that we're a threat to children and we should be denied the basic human right to marry because people don't like us and they don't want information about our existence to be available in public education. I mean, the anti-gay propaganda that fueled that campaign and did result in taking away our basic constitutional rights, it's all appalling. Well, the spawn of that campaign is what we're seeing today, is claims that are really quite outrageous, that gay people and the people who support us have been engaged in campaigns of violence and intimidation against the people that ran this campaign. And it's an outrageous fabrication, and yet it seems to have been taken much more at face value than I ever would have hoped or expected by the justices who joined that majority opinion. Now, you know, they didn't have a hearing. It's not a finding. But to those, and as I said in the blog post, anyone with a passing familiarity with the national hate crime statistics that have been stable and alarming for a very long time show that the rate of anti-gay hate crimes in this country is way disproportionate to the number of people we are. In other words, what I mean by that is that anti-gay hate crime is a huge, persistent problem. And the types of hate crimes committed based on actual or perceived sexual orientation tend to be disproportionately vicious. The term gay bashing exists in common parlance because it has been and continues to be such a problem. And so the idea that the claim of threat or harm seems to have been taken without examination by the Supreme Court as a reason to interfere with this court proceeding is deeply troubling. And the minority, the dissent, addresses that and says, look, the people who are being asked to testify as witnesses about what they were doing when they made these anti-gay ads, which is relevant evidence in this trial, those are people who voluntarily put themselves in the public spotlight and played this role for many months. And for them to now claim that suddenly they need privacy, they're vulnerable, and therefore they need to be protected from public view is, I mean, it would be laughable if the consequences weren't so disappointing for the fact that the public needs to know about this subject. If we can't educate people and dispel their misperceptions about who gay people are and about how terribly damaging anti-gay prejudice is, it makes it much more difficult to secure legal rights and fair treatment. We need to be able to address the prejudices and misperceptions in order to dispel them.
Right, absolutely. And I have to comment on you. I thought you presented this very well in your piece where you talked about these discrimination cases, and at the heart of every discrimination case is the story of injustice and its unacceptable human cost. And we have about just a couple of minutes left, and I wanted to ask you this. There's been a lot of comparison, a really interesting article in the current New Yorker, a lot of comparison of the immense importance of this, of what's going on in San Francisco right now. And people are comparing this to the Brown versus Board of Education. And then also, I can't remember the somebody versus Loving, the case in Virginia that actually overturned the
Virginia, we often say that the best named court case
right, exactly.
in American legal history. Yes.
Exactly, because it overturned
that was the case decided by the U.S. Supreme Court that struck down the remaining laws that had banned interracial marriage in some states, such as Virginia, where it was a criminal offense to marry across color lines.
And you see this case as having the same proportion in terms of importance?
Well, I should say the legal cases that resulted in Brown versus Board of Education actually was a series of federal cases, and likewise the challenges to the interracial marriage bans was a series of cases. And the same is true here. Often one case sort of comes to represent a whole body of cases, and, you know, one never knows ahead of time what case will end up becoming sort of the symbol of that body of work. But certainly this case is very important, and it is very much a part of the overall litigation effort in this country that's taking place in state courts, now in federal court, and the related educational work that helps people understand why the court successes are correct and necessary. It's all part of a social change that needs to engage the public understanding of what equality requires in a particular circumstance. I do think this trial is extraordinarily important, and the evidence that's being taken is part of that process, and certainly, by which I mean the expert evidence, but also the stories of these two plaintiff couples and their families and what it costs them in terms of the dignity and fulfillment of their lives as a family to be denied the cherished opportunity to be legally married, to be full citizens and full parts of their community as a result.
And I just would add that people everywhere have got to understand it is not acceptable to stand by and allow a basic human right to be taken from people for whatever reason they're talking about taking it from people. And people really need to follow this. They need to stand up in support of gay marriage and against the discrimination of gay and lesbian people everywhere. And Jennifer, thank you very much for joining us today.
Yeah, I'll just leave you with one thought.
Sure.
To reinforce what you just said. It is wrong to vote on other people's rights. We are one country. Equal protection has to embrace everyone. It just needs to be liberty and justice for all. And if you're not directly affected, you still need to care, because the process of change goes over a tipping point and finds success when people who are not directly affected stand on the side of what is just and right.
Okay, Jennifer, thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure, anytime.
I'll talk to
you
again. Bye now. We've been talking with Jennifer Pizer, the marriage director for Lambda Legal, and you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. We're going to take a quick break and be right back with a statement from the editors of Revolution Newspaper on the situation in Haiti. That was the OJs with Give the People What They Want. You know, if you listen to this show, you know I've played this song a few times before, but it seems that there's always a reason and a space for this song these days, and that's especially true as the horror of what's been happening in Haiti continues to unfold. I'm going to do something that I don't normally do because the situation in Haiti is so dramatically important, drastic and important and incredibly important for people to actually be thinking about and understanding what is going on. I received a statement from the editors of Revolution Newspaper, and I want to read that to people now. It'll take a few minutes, so you know, listen to it and get copies of it at revcom.us. The Haitian people need emergency assistance, not suppression and further domination. The world's eyes are riveted on scenes of horror in Haiti. The world's hearts are straining. People everywhere are trying to support the Haitian people in any way they can. Meanwhile, the clock ticks very urgently as people literally die beneath the rubble and perish on the streets as well for lack of medical care, water, food, and shelter. The means exist to rescue and aid the Haitian people. These must be made immediately available by the governments of the world, and first and foremost, the United States. While some governments have sent doctors and other forms of aid, as of Thursday morning, the United States has focused on sending paratroopers and militarily securing the area. While Obama has now promised $100 million, the U.S. government is above all concerned with ensuring the continuation of the repressive government order and controlling and/or suppressing the initiative and efforts of masses to deal with this horrible situation. $100 million is less than 1/10 of 1% of the U.S. yearly military expenses in Iraq and Afghanistan. The U.S. government must immediately focus its resources on getting aid directly to the Haitian people, putting supplies on the ground and marshaling the many doctors, engineers, construction workers, etc., who work for the government, as well as the many, many people who would volunteer to help any way that they could. This is a humanitarian emergency and must be dealt with as such. The Haitian people themselves must be assisted and not suppressed. The media, just as it did in Katrina, is already portraying the Haitian people as animals and criminals. In fact, the masses in Haiti, as they did in New Orleans during Katrina, are in the main mobilizing to collectively deal with their situation. These efforts must be supported in all aid programs, and there must be no suppression by the U.S. troops of those who are trying with all their might to save themselves and their people. Volunteers coming from other countries must be assisted by governments now sending aid to Haiti and not suppressed. History shows that there will be and must be a struggle against this system to demand that the needs of the masses actually be met and that there not be suppression of the masses. As part of this, there must be no harassment, prosecution, or deportation of Haitian immigrants within the U.S. attempting to locate or aid their loved ones and friends. Instead, government assistance must be made available to those trying to communicate to the island with a guarantee of at least temporary amnesty for any attempting to go through U.S. government agencies to do so. There must be no attacks on Haitian people attempting to flee their situation through boats. Instead, the Coast Guard must help people attempting to flee to safety, and if they are trying to get to the U.S., they must help them to do so. The disaster in Haiti is neither the result of the so-called will of God nor the fault of the Haitian people. It is the result of centuries of imperialist domination, occupation, and isolation. The news reports talk about Haiti's poverty, but they don't tell you why Haiti is so poor. Very few people know that Haiti was the scene of the only successful slave revolution in history, when the heroic descendants of African slaves drove out the strongest army in the world at that time, the French. Very few people know that the world's powers, especially the U.S., which at that time feared the influence of Haiti on the slaves in this country, and France, embarked on a policy of isolating and impoverishing Haiti. Very few people know that for nearly 20 years in the early 1900s, the U.S. Marines occupied Haiti, suppressing a liberation struggle and implanting puppets. Very few people know that the U.S. backed the infamously cruel tyrant, Papa Doc Duvalier, and then his son, Baby Doc, in the middle of the century. And all too few know that it then conspired to overthrow the popular president Jean-Bertrand Aristide in the 1990s, and then again just a few years ago in 2004. All these criminal actions, this long criminal history of oppression, flowed from the economic and political needs of the U.S. ruling classes during the time when the United States was run first by a coalition of capitalist and slaveholding classes, and then more recently, and up to today, by the ruling capitalist imperialist class. Throughout the last two centuries, the U.S. has backed up reactionary ruling classes within Haiti as part of this. In other words, the fact that the Haitian people live in terrible conditions and now must face this disaster with little resources other than their own hands and minds and up against an extremely repressive set of social relations is the result of a worldwide system. As the message, "The Revolution We Need, the Leadership We Have," from the RCP USA puts it, throughout the world, as a result of this system, a billion people or more go hungry every day, with many facing the threat of starvation. Hundreds of millions of children are forced to work like slaves and to live in putrid slums in the midst of garbage and human waste. Waves of immigrants, unable to live in their own homelands, travel the earth in search of work, and if they find it, they are worked until they can hardly stand and are forced into the shadows with the constant fear that they will be deported and their families broken apart. Growing numbers of people cannot find work at all now, with many losing their homes as well as their jobs, while others are worked even more mercilessly. Everyone is lured and driven to consume more and more at the cost of ever-mounting debt and the loss of any sense of larger purpose or meaning to life or any deeper connection with other human beings. Many are being pushed to the edge. Growing numbers are going over the edge, often lashing out in crazed desperation. Now, this system makes a terrible disaster even worse. Imperialism, of course, did not cause the earthquake, but the system of imperialism dictates how that earthquake is responded to and dealt with. In sum, this is not the best of all possible worlds. We do not have to live this way, to again quote the message, and it is through revolution to get rid of this system that we ourselves can bring a much better system into being. The ultimate goal of this revolution is communism, a world where people work and struggle together for common good, where everyone contributes whatever they can to society and gets back what they need to live a life worthy of human beings, where there are no more divisions among people in which some rule over and oppress others, robbing them not only of the means to a decent life, but also of knowledge and a means for really understanding and acting to change the world. As we work and struggle side by side to fight for the urgent demands of the Haitian people, we call on people to also engage with us in discussion on why things are the way they are, and wrangling over how to get a whole different and much better world, and to get into the work that our leader, Bob Avakian, has been doing on the kind of revolution we need and the ways that such revolution can be made. Again, you can pick this statement up at revcom.us. You can also contact Revolution at Box 3486, Merchandise Mart, Chicago, Illinois, 60654. I want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in today. This marks the end of another show. I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. I want to thank Age and Henry Carson for production assistance and Melissa Figueroa for engineering. And again, most of all, I want to thank all of you for tuning in today. You know, if you take anything away from today's show, I hope that it's a deeper sense of the truth. And on that basis, an appreciation for how much the world cries out for radical, revolutionary change. You know, one of the themes of this show is that there is a better way of life that we could be and should be living. But, as I always say, whether we get there depends on what we do. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. We're going to go out now with Haitian Fight Song from Charles Mingus. We'll be right back.